Hello, my name's Dave Emery. The following two half-hour segments deal with technological research and development primarily in the fields of biology and geophysical science. These technological developments have significant implications and, in some cases, direct applications to various national security-related fields and also implications for the study of and progress of international fascism. These segments were excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of February 2nd, 1997.
First portion of the program this evening, for lack of a better term, could be entitled Fun with Science. And we're going to be touching on a number of things going on in the scientific slash national security slash fascist domains, unfortunately, heavily overlapped. Research credit on the following goes to a listener. This is from NEA Today, that's the National Education Association's issue of January of 1997. And in the health section, we find the following, which may or may not be sinister. It's not something I feel real good about. This is entitled Guarding Against Hepatitis B. And the following was written by Linda Boyer Chuan Roon, C-H-U-A-N-R-O-O-R-O-O-N-G, a registered nurse and member of the NEA, the National Association of School Nurses. And this is about programs to inoculate school children against hepatitis B. Now, this may or may not be sinister. We would note, we'd want to note in this regard, information noted in among other, or by among other people, Dr. Alan Cantwell in his very important book, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, Dr. Leonard Horowitz in his vitally important book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, and also information noted in RFA 16, AIDS, Epidemic, or Weapon of War. There is very disturbing and very substantive information that not only was AIDS deliberately created, but that it was deliberately disseminated in the United States. The vehicle for disseminating that disease was the experimental hepatitis B vaccine program. There was also a question of contaminants of live viral vaccines with a number of viruses and other contaminants that can prove devastating to human health over a long haul. So when you see a program entitled that is aimed at vaccinating school children against hepatitis B, the warning flags should go up. I'm not saying that this is necessarily sinister, but it is alarming, and it certainly is something that warrants careful monitoring. Again, this is from NEA Today's issue of January of 97, research credit on a listener, and it reads as follows. Can you define hepatitis B? And it says, hepatitis B is a viral disease of the liver that's spread through contact with an infected person's bodily fluids. You can get hepatitis B if you have unprotected sexual contact or share intravenous drugs with an infected person, but the disease can also be spread through the sharing of toothbrushes and razor blades. There is no cure, but hepatitis B can be prevented with a series of three shots given over a few months. Question, how many school children share toothbrushes and razor blades? There are school children. We're talking about, you know, young kids who have unprotected sex, but there aren't that many kids having sex around the ages of 11 or 12. Continuing. Who should be vaccinated against hepatitis B? There are three groups who should be vaccinated against hepatitis B: newborns, adolescents around the age of 11 or 12, and anyone at risk due to lifestyle or occupational hazard. For school employees, the risk varies according to the job. All school employees who handle bodily fluids on a routine basis through, for example, diapering students or providing respiratory suctioning should consult their health care provider about the vaccination. How can adolescents get vaccinated? They can go to their health care provider, or if a program exists, they can get vaccinated at school. In my San Francisco district, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention provided funding to see if vaccinating middle school students at school made sense. We found that it did. What are the keys to a successful school-based vaccination program? To work, a school-based vaccination program must have the support of district administrators, building principals, teachers, nurses, support staff, parents, and students. It also helps to offer school staff an in-service session on the disease. Hold an assembly for the kids, and send clearly written information home to parents. To consent to have their child vaccinated, parents have to understand the disease. Without parental consent, the program can't move ahead. Once the consent is given, you can go forward. We pulled small groups of students out of the classroom for a few minutes, three times during the year. How effective was the immunization program in your district? Using incentives like pizza parties and extra credit, we got 97% of the kids to return consent forms. Two-thirds of the parents gave their permission for the vaccine. Most of those who signed refusal forms had kids who were already vaccinated. The good news is that more than 95% of students with yes forms were vaccinated with all three doses. These numbers have been replicated in other projects. How do you cope with students' anxiety? We explained the need for the shot, showed them another student or employee getting vaccinated, and used positive peer pressure. How do you get parents to sign on? By providing clear information in appropriate home languages. A few parents reject the vaccine because hepatitis B can be sexually transmitted and they don't think their child is at risk. We always mention in parent education materials that in 25% of the cases, it isn't clear how hepatitis B is transmitted. We also note that hepatitis B is easier to contract than HIV and almost 100% preventable with the vaccine. When parents know the facts, they want to protect their children. What can NEA members do to spread the word? Contact school nurses and ask what they're doing to vaccinate adolescents. Talk to administrators about getting a vaccination program started. If you're a parent, make sure your own child is immunized and talk to other parents to raise their awareness about the hepatitis B vaccine. Well, again, there may not be anything sinister about this, although there certainly are things to be very, very cautious about. Again, with the contamination of live viral vaccines with other viruses and other viral particles, and with many of those contaminants proving to be devastating to human health, it is certainly worth noting in and of itself. And again, it'll be interesting to see ethnic groups wind up getting some of these vaccines, whether it's only people of color or poor people or people in inner cities. It'll be interesting to find out just how this particular program is enacted. Again, note that the experimental hepatitis B vaccine appears to have been one of the vehicles for disseminating AIDS in the United States and perhaps elsewhere as well. We've discussed that in numerous programs, such as the interviews with Len Horowitz, Alan Cantwell, Ed Haslam, and Dr. Garth Nicholson, available from Spitfire. I also want to note that we have discussed viral contaminants in vaccines in connection with not only the work of Drs. Leonard Horowitz and Alan Cantwell, but in particular with regard to the landmark book by Ed Haslam, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. In our discussion with Ed Haslam, we not only analyzed the milieu involved with the assassination of President Kennedy and a clandestine medical laboratory that was being run by individuals connected with this milieu, such as David Ferry and perhaps Alton Oxner as well, but also the work in that laboratory of Dr. Mary Sherman, one of this country's foremost cancer experts. And Ed Haslam's developed very, very compelling information that one of the focal points of that laboratory, in which they were injecting mice with monkey viruses to see if they produced cancer, and in fact they did. But one of the focal points of that laboratory may very well have been to develop a benign strain of SV40. That's a monkey virus which contaminated the polio vaccine administered widely administered to American citizens in the late 50s and early 60s, and SV40 has proven to cause cancer in humans and animals. It is virtually identical to a cancer-causing virus called the SE polyoma. That's the Stuart Eddy polyoma. And again, the book Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the interview with Drs. Nicholson, Horowitz, and Cantwell, as well as Ed Haslam, and a three-hour interview with Ed Haslam available from Spitfire, go into this at greater length. I realize I'm setting a brisk pace here, but due to limitations of time, this is necessary. The SV40 was not only an apparently deadly contaminant in the polio vaccine in the late 50s and early 60s, but it was also the focal point of many of the early genetic engineering experiments. And those experiments may very well have given rise ultimately to the development of AIDS and perhaps other genetically engineered biological weapons as well. A frightening article, which is at the same time not as frightening as it might be. It is a classic example of modified limited hangout. It also is supplemental to a San Antonio Star article that I read into the record not too long ago, was researched for us by a listener who sent this in. The following article is from the San Francisco Examiner from January 30th of 1997, page A13. This is an AP story by Lauren Neergard, that's N-E-E-R-G-A-A-R-D, of the AP. It's Dateline Bethesda, Maryland, headlined, 50s Polio Vaccine Contaminated, subtitled, Scientists Trying to Assess What Risks Might Be, If Any. And the modified limited hangout is If Any. The article reads in part, millions of Americans were exposed to a monkey virus by taking a contaminated polio vaccine in the 1950s, and now scientists are probing whether the exposure could increase their risk of certain rare cancers. Government officials play down such fears because the types of cancer involved do not appear to be increasing among people old enough to have received the tainted vaccine. Today's polio vaccine is tested to ensure it is free of this monkey virus called SV40. But scientists recently found genetic pieces of SV40 inside tumors removed from cancer victims, and injecting the virus into laboratory animals gives them cancer. That's been known, by the way, for decades, as the remarkable book by Ed Haslam, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, demonstrates. You can also hear about that in the aforementioned three-hour interview that I did with Ed Haslam in June of 1996. That's available from Spitfire. Skipping down in the article, after a series of statements by medical officials that, well, this might not be all that bad, but it's still worth researching, we get to the meat of the article, and rather distasteful fare it is. Still, government doctors worried that even debating SV40 publicly would frighten people. We do a grave disservice to the public if we were now to question the safety of the current polio vaccines on the basis of SV40, warned Dr. Arthur Levine of the National Institute of Health. It was under the auspices of the National Cancer Institute, one of the National Institutes of Health, that AIDS appears to have been developed in conjunction with the fascist element of our national security establishment, that again discussed in many of the aforementioned archive shows. Continuing, mass vaccination with the then new polio vaccine began in 1955, but in 1960, doctors discovered SV40 in monkeys and in the vaccine. It caused cancer when injected into hamsters, so the Food and Drug Administration ordered companies to manufacture virus-free versions. By the time those versions reached the market in 1963, as many as 98 million people may have been exposed to SV40. One more time. By the time those versions reached the market in 1963, as many as 98 million people may have been exposed to SV40. One of the things that we have examined in past discussions on this subject is that virus particles of SV40 can be passed from mothers to babies through breast milk, and beyond that, it is present in semen in 25% of subjects tested. So if as many as 98 million people may have been exposed to SV40, and with viral particles apparently deleterious to human health being passed through breast milk, and with the virus being able to be passed through semen, who knows how many people have it right now. And again, one of the things to examine against the background of viral contaminants, and also against the background of the experimental hepatitis B vaccine being used to disseminate AIDS, and with children now being apparently vaccinated on a larger scale against Hep B, is one of the things we discussed in connection with Dr. Leonard Horowitz and the various interviews I've done with him, namely the fact that there's a Council on Foreign Relations document recommending that the population of the United States be reduced to the level of the late 1940s, somewhere between 120 and 140 million people. That's a 55% reduction, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. And considering that people are going to be born all the time, that doesn't sound too good. 98 million people. Is that all? Shucks. Nothing to worry about there, huh? Being facetious, of course. Speaking of injections and vaccinations, biological warfare and the unknown, with a capital T and a capital U, research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. By the way, that last is from the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, January 30th of 1997. Before that was an article from NEA Today's issue of January of 97. Following comes from the London Independent of Tuesday, December 24th of 1996. This is an article by Christopher Bellamy, B-E-L-L-A-M-Y, the defense correspondent for the London Independent. It's headlined, Gulf Troops Given Secret Injections. This concerns British troops who served in the Persian Gulf War, and there are serious questions about not only the injections given to some of our GIs who served over there, but also the possibility that a genetically engineered mycoplasma, an infectious microorganism which appears to have had a gene from HIV spliced into it, may have been utilized by Saddam Hussein in airburst Scud attacks on coalition troops, including and especially American troops. This apparently, though, the Persian Gulf War syndrome, the possibility that vaccines may have been one of the causes of some of the Persian Gulf War syndrome, which British troops are also getting, should be carefully evaluated against the background of the following article. This reads in part,
British troops in the Gulf War were given secret, still unidentified injections against biological warfare agents. Yet MPs, that's members of parliament, were subsequently assured that all those administered had been disclosed. The Independent has learned that 5 or 6 injections were given, which the Ministry of Defense still not acknowledged. Campaigners fighting for Gulf War illness to be recognized fear that some of the injections could have been experimental. The injections were not recorded on the troops' medical documents, and the RAF medical expert appointed to investigate the illness, who has since been moved to other duties, was unaware of them, skipping down. But in a private session of the House of Commons Select Committee on Defense, a Labour MP asked the Surgeon General, Vice Admiral Tony Revell, R-E-V-E-L-L, how many vaccinations the MOD did not admit to. He replied that the number was about 5 or 6. The vaccinations against plague, anthrax, pertussis, and botulinum toxin had already been discussed. Lawyers for the Gulf veterans believe the, quote, 5 or 6, unquote, secret vaccinations were in addition to the 4 already discussed. And skipping down again, however, the use, and these are the 4 discussed, however, the use of plague, anthrax, and pertussis vaccines, that's 3 of the 4, was widely known. It was reported in the press at the time and had been declassified before the brigadier wrote his letter. The secret vaccines were something else. And skipping down yet again, Kristen Lim, L-I-M-B, a scientist working with solicitors representing some of the Gulf veterans, said a number of veterans reported having blood samples taken after they received injections described only as, quote, biological warfare, unquote, and being told the samples were being sent to Porton Down, the government's biological and chemical defense establishment, for analysis. Basically, Porton Down is the equivalent of Fort Detrick, the military's top chemical and biological warfare research center for a long time, still occupied by the military and utilized by it. It was ostensibly turned over to the National Cancer Institute to become its molecular oncology lab. In fact, it was administered for a long time, perhaps still is, for the National Cancer Institute by Litton Bionetics, a wholly owned genetic engineering subsidiary of Litton Industries, a major defense contractor, and vehicle for covert operations. So, as was the case in connection with the discussion with Dr. Garth Nicholson, who along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done heroic work on the genetically engineered mycoplasma in connection with Persian Gulf War syndrome, one wonders whether perhaps British troops as well were subjected to some of the same things, and whether that also looms in the background of the British troops who have Gulf War syndrome. That article, again, researched for us by Dave White from the London Independent of December 24th, 1996, and it's on page 1, which is where it belongs. On a different note, still in connection with the theme of fun with science, and obviously I'm being facetious, I have talked in the past about the possibility, again, the possibility of seismic warfare, something that has long been forecast for the 21st century. It still remains a speculative element of this program, but there is growing evidence that that speculation may have some basis in fact. Research credit on the following also goes to a listener. This is from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, issue of January and February for 1997. In the In Brief section, we have a small article entitled Tectonic Terror. Quote, "We don't think it's impossible or wrong, but past experience suggests it is very, very unlikely," unquote, said Roger Clark, a lecturer in geophysics at Leeds University, about the possibility of using underground nuclear explosions to cause artificial earthquakes. See Nature magazine, October 10th, 1996. Clark was responding to a story in Moscow News purporting to reveal 2 secret Soviet programs, quote, Mercury, unquote, and, quote, Volcano, unquote, aimed at developing a tectonic weapon, unquote, one that could set off earthquakes from great distances by manipulating electromagnetism. According to Nature, these programs have been, quote, unofficially known to Western geophysicists for several years, unquote. Most disturbing aspects of the story, the claim that the Mercury program began in 1987, that 3 tests were conducted in Kyrgyzstan, and that Volcano's last test occurred in 1992. Well, again, this consists of modified limited hangout. They're saying here, well, we consider it very, very unlikely. And they're not talking here about nuclear explosions, but about electromagnetism, although perhaps EMP could figure in here. The fact of the matter is that Nikola Tesla had caused earthquakes the better part of a century ago. Tesla died in 1943, and much of his research is still classified with the so-called black budget, with billions and billions of dollars in completely clandestine military research having been conducted in the United States for the better part of two decades now, and with not even Congress knowing how this was used. The possibility that the United States also may have engaged in such research, successfully so, is not one that should be too readily dismissed. And again, Nikola Tesla was causing earthquakes the better part of a century ago. Much of his research is still classified. How much of that research has been carried forward into the present time is, I think, what I like to call food for thought and grounds for further research. Now, I will grant members of the listening audience who are skeptical that this is the sort of thing that inspires skepticism. You start talking about tectonic weapons, and people will say, as I've noted in the past, I'm sorry, Sonny, we're all out of candy. The fact of the matter is, I think this line of inquiry is indeed one that is important to engage in, albeit in an open-minded and speculative fashion, at least for the time being. The fact of the matter is, environmental weapons, as we noted in our interviews with Dr. Nick Begich, also available from Spitfire, environmental weapons have long been envisioned as weapons of mass destruction in the 21st century. Problem with nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons is that they can destroy large numbers of people and basically eliminate an enemy. But the goal of warfare is basically economic gain, and you cannot occupy the enemy's turf if it's irradiated or contaminated with deadly wee beasties or chemicals. The following is an excerpt from the Documents on Disarmament, 1978, put out by the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. This is published by the Superintendent of Documents, U.S. Government Printing Office, Washington, D.C. This is publication 107, released in October of 1980. And once again, as I did in one of our interviews with Dr. Nick Begich, I'm going to excerpt a letter from then-Secretary of State Cyrus Vance to then-President Jimmy Carter, submitting the Convention on the Prohibition of Military or Any Other Hostile Use of Environmental Modification Techniques. This letter, by the way, was dated August 31st, 1978, damn near 20 years ago. And please note the time frame in which this convention was drawn up. This convention, signed on behalf of the United States on May 18, 1977, that's damn near 20 years ago, and I'm speaking on the evening now of February 2nd of 1997. Beginning again, this convention, signed on behalf of the United States on May 18, 1977, is the product of a number of initiatives, the first of which was taken more than 5 years ago. In July of 1972, the Subcommittee on Oceans and International Environment of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations conducted hearings on Senate Resolution 281, expressing the sense of the Senate that the United States should seek the agreement of other governments to a treaty prohibiting the use of environmental or geophysical modification activity as a weapon of war. On February 22, 1973, Senate Resolution 281 was reintroduced as Senate Resolution 71, which was passed on July 11, 1973, by a vote of 82-10. In early 1974, at the request of the President, the Department of Defense carried out a review of the military aspects of weather modification and other environmental modification techniques. This review was followed by an interagency study of possible international restraints on these techniques. And skipping down, there's an actual excerpt from the convention signed by the U.S. and the USSR on May 18, 1977. And we read, Article 2 defines the term environmental modification techniques as, quote, any technique for changing through the deliberate manipulation of natural processes, the dynamics, composition, or structure of the Earth, including its biota, lithosphere, hydrosphere, and atmosphere, or of outer space, unquote. The understanding related to this article sets forth the following examples as illustrative of the phenomena that could be caused by the use of such techniques. Earthquakes, tsunamis, an upset in the ecological balance of a region, changes in weather patterns, clouds, precipitation, cyclones of various types, and tornadic storms, changes in climate patterns, changes in ocean currents, changes in the state of the ozone layer, and changes in the state of the ionosphere. I would note in this regard that Project HAARP would appear to be totally illegal, internationally speaking, under this provision. But please note the first two phenomena, earthquakes and tsunamis. So apparently the possibility of using earthquakes as weapons of war was contemplated by the U.S. and Soviet Union 20 years ago. I would not too readily dismiss the possibility that such weapons have been developed in the intervening period. Speaking of the book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, by Gene Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, and Dr. Nick Begich. And by the way, that last is from the Documents on Disarmament, 1978, United States Arms Control Agency and United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. The previous article about tectonic terror was from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, January and February, 1997. The book Angels Don't Play This Harp, HAARP, Advances in Tesla Technology, was published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press and copyrighted 1995 by the Earth Pulse Press. By the way, the ISBN number is 0-964-8812-0-9. Earth Pulse Press can be contacted at P.O. Box 201-393, Anchorage, Alaska, 99520 USA. Once again, Earth Pulse Press, that's one word, P.O. Box 201-393, Anchorage, Alaska, 99520, that is in the USA. Reviewing a bit of information concerning U.S. research into earthquakes as weapons. And again, military and strategic thinkers have long envisioned natural disasters such as earthquakes, storms, volcanoes, what have you, as weapons of mass destruction in the 21st century, and we are almost in that century. Among the experimental projects engaged in by the United States, as we turn to page 78 in Angels Don't Play This Harp, subtitled, by the way, Advances in Tesla Technology. Bear in mind that Nikola Tesla was creating earthquakes the better part of a century ago. This is a matter of public record for those interested in Tesla's work. Bear in mind also that Tesla died in 1943. Much of his research is still classified more than a half century after his death. And among the projects the U.S. was looking at ways to cause earthquakes as well as to detect them, was part of a project codenamed Prime Argus decades ago. The money for that came from the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA, now under the acronym ARPA. So again, please note that the U.S. was engaged in similar, quote, research into tectonic terror, as the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists issue of January, February 97 referred to it. On the admittedly speculative possibility of seismic warfare, and again, this is something that both superpowers researched carefully during the Cold War period, and I would not too readily dismiss the possibility that such technology was successfully developed. Again, if Nikola Tesla could do it the better part of a century ago, I would not dismiss the possibility that the U.S. and USSR and or USSR could have successfully done so. The United States, as a rule of thumb, was always ahead of the Soviet Union in military research. Hence, this admittedly speculative line of inquiry is one that I think should be very seriously considered, although, again, this is speculative. You've been listening to an excerpt from the One Step Beyond program of February 2nd, 1997. The discussion concerning seismic warfare will be continued in the next half-hour segment. Some of the archival references that you've heard refer to tapes that are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. Spitfire can be contacted at Post Office Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179. That is in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D. The zip code is 95005. The email address for Spitfire is ALCALAME, that's one word, repeating, ALCALAME at ix.netcom.com. Once again, the mailing address, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email address, ALCALAME at ix.netcom.com. This discussion will be continued in the next half-hour segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.